Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean,
days
I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. Thanks for listening. Today on the podcast, it's Lodro Rinsler. He's a regular contributor to the podcast. I'm sure you've heard him before if you've been listening for a while. He's the author of several books, including The Buddha Walks Into a Bar. Most recently, he published Love Hurts, Buddhist Advice for the Heartbroken. This was a talk he gave at our weekly Dharma gathering a couple weeks ago. This was actually the first talk of 2018. The title of this talk, The Year of Love. Why is 2018 the Year of Love? Well, you'll have to listen, but I'll give you a hint. Maybe it has something to do with meditation. Maybe it has something to do with how meditation helps us to soften and to wear away the habitual patterns that kind of keep us separated from each other. So could 2018 be the year of love? Well, we'll see. In the meantime, there is still time to sign up for the Meditation in the City retreat. It's taking place right here at the New York Shambhala Center beginning February 2nd. It's a week-long meditation retreat, and you can attend for the whole week. You can attend for the first weekend, the weekend of February 2nd, or by the day, whatever works for your schedule. But the unique advantage of doing a retreat in New York City is that you can bring the practice of meditation to the life we have here and now. This retreat is being led by David Perrin, another regular contributor to the podcast. Sign up. Click the link on the homepage for Meditation in the City Retreat for more information and to register. And now, here is Lodro Rinsler.
I was thinking, you know, it's a new year, and we often think about the calendar year as a time of renewal, rebirth. Many of us, though, are carrying some of like the same emotions and the same stuff over from 2017. That's okay. But I've been thinking, you know, 2017 was a hard year for many of us. And it was a year that we actually saw exposed some of the rampant racism that exists in this country. It was a year that we saw incredible gun violence, terrorist attacks, even here in our city. I remember I was actually teaching at Mindful, the drop-in meditation studios that I run, and do these like short classes, 30, 45-minute drop-in meditation classes. This woman came, and it was a nice little sip. And afterwards, she approached me. It was the day that the bomb went off here in the city, not so long ago. And she said that she was on her way to the post office, and then she got to it, and everything had been cordoned off, and she couldn't get there. And someone said, "There, a bomb went off." And her first thought was, "Oh, I guess I need to find another post office then." And she said, you know, she started walking, and she looked up on her phone, she started walking in that direction. She realized in that moment that this last year had completely desensitized her to these sorts of things. And she said, "Okay, I don't want that." So she actually came to the studio an hour later and practiced meditation so that she could actually work on softening. And I think in a city like this, many of us go around with this pretty big suit of armor that we carry. And it's actually made up of this really seemingly indestructible stuff called our habitual patterns, the ways that we've coped with things so far. And it could be stuff from our family, stuff from past relationships, stuff from friendships, whatever it might be. We sort of have woven together this pretty indestructible armor that keeps us shut off from the rest of the world. In our tradition, we actually often refer to this as a cocoon. all of the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves and about the world around us make up this really intricate cocoon that keeps us sheltered and doesn't allow us to actually connect with the world around us. And meditation, whether you prefer the armor or the cocoon metaphor, essentially takes this industrial strength Brillo pad and just starts rubbing away like a jackhammer. Just constantly, every time we sit, we're essentially going like drilling down on that. So at some point, we might notice that we feel a little raw or a little exposed or a little tender or a little vulnerable. And that actually means that the practice is working, believe it or not, that we actually do soften. And when we do wear away, so there's a little bit of a hole in that armor or that cocoon, we actually realize that we're okay, that we're whole and complete as is, and that actually there's a lot of open-heartedness to offer to the world if we can tear past some of the ways that we close ourselves off. I mention all of this because it is January 2nd and it's a new year. And in my mind, if 2017 was marked with a lot of aggression, I would love to think that 2018 could be marked as a year of love. Now, there's two things I want to actually talk about, really. One is the meditation practice that we just engaged in, and the other is a practice known as loving kindness. Or really, it's one of four practices I'll discuss overall, but is a pretty steady practice that's done in many Buddhist traditions. So meditation, let's start with this mindfulness of the breath thing, right? So obviously mindfulness is like pretty cool now. When I grew up in this particular tradition of Shambhala, it was not cool when I was growing up. It was probably not the only reason I was pushed into lockers. It didn't help, though, that I meditated. It's weird, but now it's cool. And I think part of it is all of the science that's like, hey, if you meditate regularly, you actually become more productive and more efficient and all of those things, which is fine. I'm not opposed to us actually becoming more productive or efficient, but I think a lot of times the science around meditation misses a pretty crucial element, which it also makes us kinder. If we're doing it right, it really does. I remember, not to keep harping on different stories from Mindful, but I'm coming from work. There is a guy who had been coming and meditating pretty regularly, and he showed up with a friend. He actually just saw him today, which is probably why I'm reminded of it. And he brought this friend, and I knew him well enough to joke. I said, "What are you doing hanging around with this jerk?" And she said, "It's so funny you mentioned that because he was a jerk for so long." This guy apparently was not the best of friends to her. And she said, the thing is we have lunch every Tuesday together. That's our thing. So every Tuesday we get together, we have lunch. And I noticed recently he started actually listening to me a lot. And then he would follow up with me later on in the week. He would text me and be like, "Hey, how'd it go with that thing?" And I was like, "What's going on with you? You're actually much nicer." He goes, "I don't know. I have no idea." She goes, "Is it because you've been meditating?" He goes, "Oh, maybe it's that." The effects of meditation are so subtle, we often don't notice them for ourselves. But it's like that. It's like, oh, we have it mirrored back. You're kinder. You're more present than you used to be. So these two things go hand in hand. But why would we ever get kinder? Now, I'll jump back into the science for a second. When I say we're going to become more productive, more efficient, all those wonderful things, meditation, at least this mindfulness of the breath thing that we do, has had so much science done around it. Different universities have covered that we have increased gray matter in the hippocampus after we've been meditating for about 8 weeks. We have more activity in the ACC. This is just part of the overall idea, but what does that mean? It means that we are creating new neural pathways in the brain. So the neural pathway that, I'm not going to say who it is, so I will pick on them. I have a friend, and she has the same computer as I do. So sometimes I'll open up the computer, and I'll be like, "Oh, it's her computer." And I'm always devastated because there's about 100 tabs open on her internet. I was like, "I don't know. I don't think that's the way to live, man." That's a busy mind. That's a lot to have to deal with at the end of the day. So it's like meditation normally our mind just goes and goes and goes. It goes on any sort of pathway that comes up. Oh my God, I forgot to do that thing. And then we go down that rabbit hole of that thing. So it's almost like if we were scrolling on Facebook and we clicked on one link and we're like, and now I'm going to click another and I click another and we have 100 tabs open in our mind. That's how many of us operate on a day-to-day basis because we haven't actually started to take any time to tame it, to actually work with it. Tame is a little bit of, sometimes people use aggressive terms around meditation. I don't like tame necessarily. Befriend our mind, but there is some element of just acknowledging it and then we come back to the breath in meditation. That's the beautiful part of it. So every time that you drift off in meditation, and if it was 100,000 times in the practice period, that's fine. Because the beautiful thing is that you went up to the Xbox at the top of the tab and clicked it, and then you came back to that other screen. That's what we do. I got lost, I come back. I got lost, I come back. That's where the new neural pathways actually get formed. That it's not we sit here completely peacefully and everything is awesome and okay. That'd be awesome. Like meditation would have caught on much quicker if it was like as relaxing as a massage. I believe that. But it's a little bit of heavy work of actually having to go and click and close out those tabs. Actually keep acknowledging that we have drifted off in thought and keep coming back to the breath. But that's the moment that we're, instead of multitasking, starting to single task. We're retraining the brain to just be present with one thing, which is in this case the breath. So that's that first equivalent of, okay, we become more present. Let me get to the kindness part. Because alongside needing more love in this year, I actually really think we need more kindness too. The kindness element is that moment that we go to click that X. What voice do we use with ourselves when we actually drift off in meditation? Are we sitting here meditating and we acknowledge that we drifted off and we might say, for example, thinking. We come back to the breath. And then the same sort of thought comes up and we go, thinking. We come back to the breath. And the same thought comes up again. We go, thinking. We're yelling at ourselves in our own heads. Now, not surprisingly, that's going to create or perpetuate neural pathways based on aggression, right? Why would we think otherwise? If we sit here and use meditation as a way to beat ourselves up, that's actually not going to be so good for us. And then what happens when we sit down with our friend that we meet with for lunch every Tuesday? We start beating them up, hopefully not physically, but that aggression starts to come up. So this moment when we notice that we have drifted off is actually the prime moment to create these new neural pathways, not just to be present, but to be kind. So when we acknowledge that we drifted off, it's like, oh, hey, not a big deal. We come back to the breath. Same thought? Okay. Cool. Not a big deal. Come back. So we're actually treating ourselves with the sense of unconditional friendliness and support. I heard once someone say that we would never talk to our best friend in the way that we talk to ourselves in meditation. So many of us are like, you asshole, why are you so bad at this, right? Like we would never say that to another person, hopefully. We'd be like, hey, I noticed that you're struggling there. You know, like it's a little gentler. And that's the tone that we actually have to work our way toward. The tone of actually being kind to ourselves every time we drift off. I see it, not a big deal. I've probably told this story here before, but I'm going to do it again because it feels appropriate. There's a wonderful Buddhist teacher in our tradition of Shambhala known as Pema Chodron. She's written about 3,000 books. In fact, these days, if she opens her mouth, they're like, let's transcribe that. Let's make it into a book. But it's still genius no matter what she does, so it works. I won't continue down that, but they're all very good. There's a story, and I've already told about a dozen different ways, but there's a story of before she wrote any of these books, she was actually asked by her teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the gentleman above my right shoulder, to the left of you on the shrine above us, the man who really brought these teachings to the West. He asked her to go to Texas and to teach the basic meditation that we did today on his behalf. And she walked into a room, and her words was filled with 20-something-year-old cowboys in 10-gallon hats. She gave the meditation instruction, and she told people to be kind to themselves when they did it. People were like pretty blank-faced, and basically she said, okay, cool. And she left, being like, that was probably a waste of everyone's time. Many years later, she was coming back through Texas, and she was approached by a man. And he said, I've been meditating ever since you were last here. And she was shocked. She goes, because of me? He goes, yeah, the instruction you gave. And I hope you don't mind, but I changed the instruction a little bit. Which, by the way, at this point I've been teaching meditation 16, 17 years. That's like the last thing anyone wants to hear. Like, I changed that thing you told me to do. And it's like, no, don't. She said, what did you do? He says, well, at first, I'd start getting aggressive with myself. Same thing that I was just saying, thinking, same thought, thinking. Before I know it, I'm yelling at myself in my head. But then I remembered what you said about being gentle to myself. So now, when a big thought comes up, I just say, thinking good, buddy. I love it. I mean, it's so Texan, isn't it? But it's also a perfect example of that attitude that we could have for ourselves. Like, hey, we're just befriending ourselves. So Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, his son, Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche, is the gentleman above this shrine to my, above my left shoulder. And he oversees the several hundred Shambhala centers worldwide. And his first book on meditation, which I think is such an excellent go-to, is Turning the Mind into an Ally, which is, at the time, I was like, what a weird title. Now, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's all we do in meditation. We're just befriending ourselves. We're turning the mind into an ally. Not something we have to struggle so much against. Not something we have to subdue or whip into shape. I've had a puppy for about a year now, and I often think about him when I'm meditating because it's like, this dog will run after anything. Like, he'll just see a person half a block away and be like, person, and like just wants to go. And if I just grab that leash, I'm like, no, that dog is terrified. That dog doesn't want to walk. That dog doesn't want to go outside, right? If it's a gentle, no, sweetie, like, come on back. Maybe we'll see if that person wants to say hi. You know, like, it's like a gentle suggestion. All of a sudden the dog's like, I love this. So same thing with our mind. If we just say, I'm going to whip my mind into shape, I'm going to yank it back every time it tries to wander, we're not going to want to do this for very long. We're going to not fall off the cushion physically, but sort of like falling off the wagon. It's like, you know what I mean? We're not going to stay consistent with our practice. We're not going to do it. But if we're actually very gentle with ourselves and very kind with ourselves, hey, it's not a big deal, come on back. We actually find that it's an enjoyable process to hang out with ourselves and get to know ourselves better. Okay, so this is all around kindness and the practice that we did, mindfulness of the breath, often known as shamatha, calm abiding, sometimes translated as peaceful abiding meditation. Now, for the nerds in here, I'm going to go into what are known as the four Brahma Viharas. Because in addition to kindness and meditation and being with the breath, I really do think that this is a good year for us to practice love. And I think the practices of these Brahma Viharas are essential to the work that we would do if we want it to be so. So the Brahma Viharas, Brahma, godly, sublime, Vihara could be translated as abode. So sometimes it's translated as sublime abodes, divine abodes, godly abodes. More often than not, it's just translated as the four immeasurables. And this is a set of teachings that exist across the different traditions of Buddhism. And it's these four aspects that we could actually cultivate on a regular basis, not just on the meditation cushion, but off of it as well. So these four Brahma Viharas, these four ways, essentially, of loving. So it's interesting that we would typically call this the four immeasurables, because it actually means, since they're all loving practices, that our love, believe it or not, is immeasurable. Often when we get very hurt, we're like, no, I'll just do a slight tangent. My last book was called Love Hurts, and it was a book on heartbreak. And there's a small chapter in there being like, hey, if you honestly believe that you will never love anyone again, you reach out to me. Here's my personal email address. I included it. include your phone number. I will call you and tell you that you will, which is true. I really do believe that for everyone who's been so hurt, that we really can, just the nature of who we are is loving and lovable. And that's not just my personal experience, but also the teachings in this tradition. So I really do believe that. And our love is actually boundless. Even when we're hurt, we might want to armor up again or spin those threads of the cocoon quite tightly. But at some point, we like the natural way of life. We start to actually undo that, and we actually start to want to love again. And believe it or not, I thought, oh, okay, maybe someone will someday email me. Every effing day. Not kidding you. It's slow. I mean, the book came out a year ago now, so it slowed down to like 3 to 4 times a week. But for that first 6 months, 9 months or so, it was every day. And it's remarkable. If you feel that way, please know that you're not alone. Every day, or every couple days at this point.
Did you call them?
Yeah. Sorry, I should have included that part. Yeah. The question was, did I call them? And the answer is yes. Actually, there's an article coming out in the Washington Post about this, because this reporter found out about it and was like, this is the weirdest thing I've ever heard, that I actually call these people. And some, more often than not, it goes to voicemail, because these days people are like, foreign number, I'm not answering that, you know? But sometimes I get people on the phone and we talk for a few minutes. Often people are just touched that someone would actually call and say it. That's the main exchange, that someone's like, oh, you actually cared enough to actually remind me of these things. Because sometimes we just need to hear that we are able to love. Sometimes we're just at that point where we don't feel like we have the bandwidth to do it. And that if we're at that point that we will heal, and that even the most devastating and painful emotions are impermanent, it's good to know, good to be reminded of, that we could heal from them and then love again. So these loving practices, these four immeasurables, meaning that our love could be immeasurable, they are loving kindness, sometimes known as metta, or in another translation, maitri, compassion, karuna, sympathetic joy, mudita, and equanimity, upeksha. Now, these practices are often referred to in the Metta Sutras, Loving Kindness Sutras, as taught by the Buddha. This is not something that came out like 3 weeks ago and it's being trendy. This is something that's been around for 2,600 years, these four elements of loving. Now, I should also mention, this is where I get in for the nerds, that for people who are traditionally accustomed to doing loving kindness practice, that actual practice didn't come about till the 5th century. There is a great teacher known as Buddha Ghosha, who is not the original Buddha. It's just his name happened to be Buddha Ghosha. He happened to go into the right line of work. No, I'm sure that was the teaching name. So he systematized the first of these loving kindness practice so it could actually be done as a meditation practice. And we've been doing it ever since. Loving kindness practice is something that has been done, and the sort of particular steps of it are different in different traditions. Even I was teaching this alongside David Perrin, who's a teacher here in New York, Shambhala, and he and I were comparing notes. And I always start with ourself, offering ourselves loving kindness. He's like, no, I do that later. It's like, good to know. So it's not that there's such a discrepancy within this tradition, but it's actually that every tradition has different ways of organizing these steps. But basically, I will give you my version slash what all of the steps are, which is that we would probably sit for a few minutes like we did before, and then we would actually bring to mind someone, first ourself, then someone that we love very dearly or admire. Sometimes this could even be a mentor or a benefactor. And then we might move to someone that we generally like, get along with, then we would move to someone who's actually neutral, someone that we actually don't necessarily feel one way or another about, and then someone that we actually find difficult, and then we group them all together. Pema Chodron talks about this as dissolving the boundaries, because we're essentially dissolving the boundaries of opinion of I like you, I don't like you, I don't know you, and just offering our heart to all of them. And then we actually start to radiate out. So if we were doing this practice now, we would sit here and actually contemplate that we're sitting in a room full of people who took their Tuesday night and actually want to do this sort of thing. And we might feel some sense of love and appreciation for that. And then we would continue to expand out and contemplate that we're sitting here in Chelsea and that we're in New York City, New York State, and continue to radiate out and out until that love did feel immeasurable. But I wanted to just start a little bit and like dig in a little bit on some of these steps because I think they're interesting. When I lead the practice, I often start with offering ourselves love, and this is often the most difficult part for many of us. But as the Zen master RuPaul once said, if you can't love yourself, how in the hell are you going to love anybody else? And I think it's a good point that we really do need to deepen the well of love for ourselves before we actually start to offer it to others. So if we can't, if I often like to work with images. So if I were sitting here, I'd imagine myself as I saw myself in the mirror as I was rushing out the door. Or I might imagine myself, if I'm struggling with this, as a young child, maybe 7, 8 years old. And just notice that feeling of whatever arises. That we might even have judgment. We might have all these sorts of things. But whatever comes up in that moment, we actually go through traditional phrases. And this is another thing that varies tradition by tradition. Sometimes in this tradition, we might say, may you enjoy happiness and be free from suffering. In other traditions, we might go through four of them, like, may you be happy. May you be healthy. May you feel safe. May you feel at ease. So different ways of doing it. But the idea of it, the almost energetic exchange of it all is the same. That we are in this moment just offering this aspiration. May you actually be happy. May you just feel that happiness, if even for a moment. May you feel safe. May you feel healthy. May you feel at ease. Sometimes once someone's done this for a longer time and is very used to the practice, they might even not necessarily resonate with one of those and they might swap something in, like may you feel loved. May you feel peaceful. That last one's more traditional, actually. May you feel peaceful. but it's actually sort of a profound experience. I remember the woman who really quite literally wrote the book on this practice, Sharon Salzberg, the book is called Loving Kindness. She was telling me that when she first decided to do a loving kindness retreat, she focused, I think it was for an entire month, just on loving kindness for herself. And she was like, this is miserable. It was hard. It was really hard for her. And yet there was this amazing moment where, I forget if it was a snow globe or a glass, but she was getting ready to go somewhere and she knocked it over and it broke everywhere. And her typical reaction would have been like, oh, you klutz. Why are you always like this? And in that moment, she was like, oh, it's okay. She's like, oh, I think this practice is starting to pay off. Right? Like there's just, again, the effects of meditation are so subtle. So the idea that we would actually start to offer ourselves more of tenderness, more kindness and forgiveness through this practice is quite profound. And even if it always, even if it feels a little bit like a struggle at times, it adds up in terms of starting to show up in the rest of our life. And again, then we move to people we either love or admire, people we like, people we, the neutral people I think are really interesting. It could be someone that you see down the hall from you in New York, right? It's weird that we don't know our neighbors here, but we don't. Well, maybe you do. And if so, I would like to meet you because I think that's great. You do. Awesome. I think that's wonderful. Very rarely do we like know all the people in our building, you know? It could be someone like that, that we just sort of flash their image. It could be the person that delivers mail to your place of employment. It could be someone you see at a local coffee shop. it's actually interesting. I, for a long time, my neutral person for about a year and a half was the person who delivered mail to Mindful. And then he got swapped out and we have a new mail person. I was like, oh, but I really like him. Like I have like this total soft spot in my heart for this person. And most of my exchanges with him are like, hey, how are you doing? Thank you so much. You know? But we are surrounded. I mean, this is a city of 8 million people. We are surrounded by neutral people. People we don't necessarily feel one way or another about. So the idea of starting to actually contemplate just one on a given day and think, oh, I just want you to be happy. I want you to feel safe. That's actually sort of profound. And we start to notice more and more of the people around us. Just as we go through the streets, we actually start to raise our gaze more and just acknowledge the humanity of the people around us. These seemingly neutral people actually become people we want to connect to. And then there's the difficult person. This is a very hard practice. This is, if you don't struggle with offering love to yourself, this is where you might struggle, the difficult person. Because we all have, well, I don't want to say we all have difficult people. Sometimes we struggle to find a difficult person. If that's the case for you, it might just be that person that sent you that really annoying email. That totally counts. All the way up to someone who stands against everything that you stand for, right? It could go anywhere in between. But we hold their image in mind. And we also, like, as we say things like, may you enjoy happiness and be free from suffering, or may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be safe, may you be at ease, we're also acknowledging the fact that all of these beings up to now, including this being, are suffering. They're having a hard time. They are deeply confused, and that's probably where our conflict comes from. So it's almost selfish, right? We're like, may you suffer less so I actually don't have to deal with it, you know? But it's still a genuine aspiration of like, may you actually be free from suffering. To the best of our ability, we work with that difficult person. And I should caveat this with, I don't recommend actually going to someone that may have traumatized you in some way. It's not a good place to start with this sort of practice. It's often much better to work with, again, maybe someone that like is pissing you off at work or something like that. And then if you can build to something like that, more power to you. But I don't think you should start there. And then we bring them all together. I often like to think of them sitting around like a dining room table, like having the most awkward dinner ever. And see if we can actually dissolve those boundaries of I like, I don't like, I ignore. Like just actually offer a sense of open-heartedness. May we be happy. May we be healthy. Because we're also included in that. And then we start to radiate this out to see how measurable that love can be. One last thing on the difficult person, actually. I have a meditation student who's, I think this is okay to say, it's anonymous enough. Her partner's ex-wife is a very difficult person for her. And she was like, I don't know what to do about it. And I took a page out of Pema Chodron's book and I was like, hey, I read this thing. What if you put her picture somewhere? Often I say, just put it out somewhere in your house. In her case, because she didn't want to put that person's picture up in like the family space, she just carried it in her wallet. And every time you see that photo, you actually do one of these phrases, may you be happy. Or if that feels totally insincere, something that feels meaningful to you, some version thereof. May you suffer less, whatever it might be. And it transformed the relationship of just on a regular basis, having to just acknowledge that person, that difficult person, not get stimulated, not like there's no emails coming out of that photo. There's no phone calls. There's no dirty words. It's just a photo and be like, okay, for this moment, I can acknowledge our shared humanity and just make an aspiration for your good, for your wellness. And it really made it easier to work with that person. So that's another, I often like loving kindness practice because the more we practice it, the more we can do this on the spot. I started, as I'm going down the streets, not all the time, but a fair amount at this point, taking it as a practice where with just random people in the street, just sort of like, not often I can't meet their eyes, but just acknowledging that they're walking down the street and just making the aspiration, may you be happy. I don't know where they're going. I don't know what they've got going on. They could already be extremely happy, good for them. But I'm still, just the act of making the aspiration has actually been quite powerful for me. So this is the first of these four Brahma Viharas, loving kindness practice, metta practice. And I'll briefly go through the others. The second is compassion, which, I mean, quite frankly, I can and probably should give a whole talk on. I'm back here in 2 weeks, and maybe that's the topic. Because compassion is another good one for our particular year. But compassion, in the Buddhist tradition, comes from karuna. Karuna is linked to ninja. Ninja is noble heart. It's the Tibetan word, noble heart. So it's a sense of actually opening our heart to others. Like when we do take that Brillo pad to the armor and it's open, can we just be there? And that often means that we are there with people as they suffer. It's a sense of empathy. Because the more we actually, and this is also, by the way, why I think meditation and kindness are linked. The more we actually sit there and stew in our own stuff, and become really familiar with the ways that we experience fear or aggression or jealousy or whatever it might be, the more we start to notice that that same stuff happens to other people. Like, oh, that difficult person's actually just triggered and they're really angry or they're really jealous or whatever it might be. And the more, because we know how hard it is to deal with because we've been sitting here on the meditation cushion, the more we say, oh, I see that in you, and it's not I judge you or I think I'm better than you, it's, oh, my heart goes out to you because I know how hard that is. It's a natural response. It's not forced. It's not even conscious half the time. It's just, oh, I see that. Oh, that's difficult. And our heart just opens a little. A sense of compassion. So I often think of empathy and sympathy as somewhat different things. Sympathy is like, I don't know where you're coming from at all, but I'm sorry it's happening. And that happens, obviously. But empathy is more of, oh, I know what that's like. So I'm not up here and you're down here. We're level playing field. And if you ever meet a Buddhist teacher who is coming at like their stuff from the angle of like, I'm spiritually advanced and I know better. My heart goes out to all you poor people down there who are not as advanced. Run. Because I think so much of the beauty of this particular tradition is that we're sort of like eye to eye going through suffering together. It's really important that we actually stand shoulder to shoulder in discomfort. And that's compassion, that we would actually be there for others in these times. And I could, again, maybe later on in a different talk, I'll go in depth about that. But the third of these is mudita, sympathetic joy. Sympathetic joy is the sense, if compassion is we are there for other beings and we acknowledge and are there for their suffering, sympathetic joy is that we actually are there for other beings and we acknowledge and see their joy. That it's not just like, oh, I'm going to wallow in the suffering part of Buddhism, but there's also this other element of really being open to actually experiencing true joy. And sometimes that joy means that we're actually rejoicing in the success of others. For example, if you've ever been to a wedding and you really just felt like, yeah, this couple's doing it right, you know? Like, they're doing their thing. They're having a beautiful day together. They're celebrating their love, and hopefully they'll spend a lifetime together. And that fills your heart. That's what I'm talking about. That's like, that's it. That's much more important than me using a lot of words. If you know what I mean in that experience, that's important. Which is different than what the enemy, one of the enemies of sympathetic joy is, which is, I should have dated that person before they got into this relationship. You know, like, that could have been me. You know, that sense of comparing mind, like the jealousy, the envy. It's very common that we shut ourselves off from sympathetic joy because we try to compare ourselves to others. Again, Sharon Salzberg, another story that she told during one of her talks, which I really love, was the idea that she wanted to be on the New York Times bestseller list. And that was like a pretty big dream. And all of her like friends who were big shots were like getting the New York Times bestseller list. And she's like, oh, maybe someday. And then this book I mentioned before, Loving Kindness, hit. And the publisher sent this email being like, congratulations. It finally happened. Her heart filled with joy. She's like, oh, cool. And, like, people are reading. They enjoy the book. That's great. and she's scanning down. And apparently the publisher sends over, like, the number of weeks that you have been on the New York Times bestseller list. And she sees her name, Sharon Salzberg, Loving Kindness, 1 week. And I think, I don't remember the name of, I think it was the person who wrote the book, What to Expect when you're Expecting. And it was right below her, and it was like, whoever that is, What to Expect When You're Expecting, like, 1 billion weeks. Right? It's like still selling very well. And she, like, her heart sunk in that moment. She's like, oh, this is that. This is that comparing mind. Like, I got what I wanted, and now I'm going to try and compare myself to someone else, and now I'm unhappy. That's it, in a heartbeat. Right? It's not a good way to live. We know this. But it's literally retraining the mind to say, what can I actually connect with in terms of joy in this moment? A lot of times this part of year, people go into, like, gratitude lists and things like that, which is great. But I think it's important, whatever it means to you, even if it's just at the end of your day, thing, like, what can I appreciate about today? And are there things in my life, people in my life, that I can rejoice in their joy? Right? What's going on? My mom's having a really good, like, health thing right now. That's great. She had some bad health before. Like, I can actually rejoice in that because that really brings me joy. It's important to actually take the time to do that, but it's very rare that we do it. Okay, and the fourth of these is upeksha, equanimity. Equanimity, I mean, I feel like that's what people often want when they get into meditation. They're like, I just want to be totally peaceful, because that's what we sort of equate it with. Another translation of this word, the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh once translated upeksha as inclusiveness, which I really sort of prefer, that we could be all-inclusive with our heart. That we could actually allow our love to be so vast that we could actually just start to, whoever comes into our vision, our line of sight, our email inbox, whatever it might be, we say, oh, could I actually offer my heart to this person? I often think about equanimity as that moment when we're descending on an airplane, and if you live here in New York, I often think about it in New York, bless you both. And before we get into the streets and we're like, there's that person I like, and there's my worst enemy. We're just looking at ants, right? We're just seeing, like, these little cars going around, and it looks almost ridiculous that we all hold ourselves so seriously because it's just tiny. And yet, in that moment, could we actually be like, oh, could I actually open my heart without necessarily getting to the boundaries of I like you, I don't like you, I ignore you? Just actually letting it be open enough to be inclusive enough for all beings. So something to work toward in the year ahead, for sure. But I think, honestly, if we are not going to... Let me take a step back. Many of us, in the face of incredible societal aggression, come to the conclusion of, I can't do anything. Why would I sit here on a Tuesday night and give a talk all about love, loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity so that we could actually cultivate more love in our life? It's so that we could actually, as individuals, develop this deep well of love for ourselves and the people in our life that we could start to actually offer it when we're not on the meditation cushion. Sakyong, in a talk many years ago, said, society can feel very overwhelming if we think of it as something big and out there. Right here, we're at this, like, nice, inclusive, like, Shambhala Center, but out there, it's a rough city, part of a rough world. And it's dualistic for us to be like, we're in here, that's out there. He says, society could be two people sitting down and having tea. What's your name?
Diogenes.
Diogenes, did I say it right? So if you and I sat down and had tea, we would have, like, an hour, say. And in that hour, we could sit there and totally perpetuate aggression and totally, like, gossip about celebrities that are in the news and all of that, right? Like, that's fine. And then we would carry that energy into our workplaces or our family life or whatever is going on the rest of the day. Or we could sit down and actually talk about things that we find are really meaningful, things that actually come from our heart. And in that moment, we would then be carrying that energy into all of the interactions in the rest of our day. So society not only could be two people, it could also have a ripple effect. It's like the old Robert Kennedy speech that's like a stone thrown in a pool of water. We don't always see where the ripples will go, but they go. That's just the nature of way things are. So in this case, if we actually turned our attention to actually trying to cultivate love, we could actually then go out and feel that sort of forward momentum in all the other interactions in our day. And if there are 100 some odd people here, that's 100 people in the city of New York who have families and workplaces and schools and places they volunteer and all sorts of communities, mini societies that they could show up for with the intention of offering love in all of its many forms. And if we continue to not talk about Buddhism and say why everyone should come to the... I mean, feel free to tell people to come here, but it's a great place. But if actually start to show up and embody these principles that we talk about here, actually embody love, that will have a profound influence on everyone we meet. Love is not a Buddhist thing. We just happen to have these four great immeasurable aspects of systematizing it. But between doing the practice and offering ourselves kindness and doing loving kindness, offering compassion, sympathetic joy, resting in equanimity, through all of this, we could become more loving people and we could have a profound influence on the world around us. So I think if we actually wanted to commit to this sort of thing, we could really help society. I really believe that. So we have a few minutes. If there are any reflections or questions that you might have.
The thing that I was thinking about when you were... The sympathetic comparison, is what was it?
A sympathetic joy.
Sympathetic, no, it was when you feel jealous, like the jealousy.
Comparing mind.
Comparing mind.
Which is not a Buddhist term, that's just a thing that happens, yeah.
Yeah, comparing mind. The thing... That makes me think of is just something that I had been talking about recently, which is not necessarily comparing yourself to others, but comparing yourself to a past version of yourself or your own accomplishments in the past. And sort of like, I've heard the term like chasing the dragon, you know, and like, I think like a really, like a pop culture example is that, you know, Michael Jackson had Thriller, which was the best selling album of all time, and spent the rest of his career trying to like outdo himself. And I guess, I think a lot of people struggle, I think I personally struggle with that sometimes more than comparing myself to others. And I'm wondering, do you feel that the same techniques are useful in that situation, or?
I do. Yeah. Thank you. No, I'm kidding, I'll go on. I do. I think in this case, whether it's I used to have a better job, or I used to have more hair or whatever it might be. I think the loving kindness practice gradually starts to undo those knots. I mean, that alongside the meditation practice, because both of them are the shamatha practice, because both of them are saying, can you actually be present with the way things are? Can we drop into the moment here and actually feel whatever we're feeling and be with who we are? And I think comparing ourselves to past versions of ourselves, or even many people have comparing ourselves to who we think we should be or where we should be. Like, I'm at this age, I should be at this point in my career, or I should be married, or whatever it might be. Yeah, all of this sort of comparing mind aspect is not necessarily helpful and actually closes us off. So the Sakyong once said, if you want to be miserable, think only of yourself. If you want to be happy, think of others. So sometimes when we think about sympathetic joy, the quickest turnaround for this is like, where could I find this? If I'm like really lost down the rabbit hole of comparing myself to who I used to be or where I think I should be, play with an effing puppy, you know? Or a child, or just someone, like spend time with someone who's feeling vibrant and happy and actually like rejoice in that happiness. Put our attention on someone other than us just for a moment and see if our heart opens in a different way and moves us out of that particular rabbit hole into something better.
It's interesting, this is a follow-up on this comment. It's interesting what you said earlier about us thinking of ourselves first and then people who are you know, from the easier to the harder end of the spectrum. And then you said that sometimes ourselves, you know, is one of the hardest person to love. And I think one of the common threads there is expectation. It's almost like a definition. People who have been nice to us or people who have met or exceeded our expectation. People who are on the other end of the scale are people who don't meet their expectation. And one of the, you know, things that makes it hard for us to love ourselves, if I can say that, is we don't meet our expectations. What I understand from this technique is that you basically set this aside, right? This is not about analyzing our relations, right? It's about saying, I want you to be happy, irrespective of what happened between us, why this, and then. So basically, all this expectation is going to be eroding by itself in some way, or transforming.
Yeah, that's so, exactly it. So it's the idea that we would actually, no one really, once they have that neutral person in mind, no one ever says, I really struggled with that neutral person, right? Because there are no expectations right. of the neutral person, or very rarely are there. So, yeah, there's an element here of if we want to close our heart down really quickly to someone, we should pile a lot of expectations on them. Right? And we, for anyone who's been in a long-term relationship, you know this, right? Like, that's not a good... Like, at one point, we start dating someone, it's all brand new, and it's lovely, and we're just discovering who they are. And then once we think, oh, okay, I know enough about them, and we close off our heart, right? We're like, you're the person that likes to tango. And they're like, no, I used to like to tango. Now I like to swing dance. And you're like, who are you anymore? You're letting me down, because our expectations are so solid and real. So I think you're right. That loosening of the expectations is a really important part in terms of letting the heart soften and open.
Yeah. When you try to find love and kindness for yourself, is that independent of high self-esteem, low self-esteem, or average self-esteem? Or how is it related?
Man, I'll get technical and Buddhist on this. I often think about self-esteem. I mean, so baked into that first word is the self. And within Buddhism, the self is actually like not as solid and real as we think. It's actually, we are this conglomeration of like skin and flesh and bones and love and experience and all these different things. And those things are constantly shifting and changing. That's just the nature of the self, that we're constantly in flux. I often think about the example that every 7 years it said that our every cell in our body dies and is replaced. So like, this is not the same body I had 7 years ago. It's just not. And yet we hold a really solid notion of who we think we are. This is who I am. My name is Lodro. I'm an author. I run this meditation studio. I teach here at the Shambhala Center. Like I am, you know, I'm engaged. I've got all these different things. I sort of like, this is who I am. Now, if Mindful went under, or my fiance broke up with me, or I was never asked to teach after tonight, you know, like, then that identity would start to crumble. So we were just talking about expectations. Like, that's a good example of, like, my expectations hold my ego up and support it and try and make it solid, when in fact I'm constantly in flux. That's just the way things are. So self-esteem... Buddhist teachings actually start to undermine that and start to say, actually, you're more fluid than that. You contain effing multitudes. You know, that's just the nature of who you are. So the idea of offering our self-love is like actually acknowledging, as we were talking about before, not who I used to be, or not, you know, only offering love to the person I could be someday. It's offering love to ourselves as we are in this exact moment, which is entirely different than tomorrow. So it's actually a much more fluid understanding of the self. That we are offering ourselves love for who we are in this exact moment, knowing that this moment is now changed. Does that make sense?
Thank you, it does.
Okay. And after that extremely challenging question, I think we should close. But thank you again all for your patience, for your diligence in being here tonight. I know it's very cold out, so the fact that you brave the cold, you all get gold stars, and you can collect them at the front desk. I believe we have some light food and drinks, and please feel free to hang out, get to know one another. This is a lovely community. Okay, have a wonderful evening.
All right. Thank you, Lojo. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats. Also, our week-long retreat, the Meditation in the City retreat, begins soon, February 2nd. Click the link on the homepage for more information. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org, your questions, comments, suggestions. Our weekly Dharma gathering is every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person. You're invited. Come. If you live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Thanks for listening. Later.